Thank you. Good afternoon. You know, we had a wonderful time of worship together this morning, and then a great time of fellowship over the posters and lunch afterwards. And usually on a Sunday afternoon, after all that's happened, I'm ready for some downtime. And instead of that, you've got me. So if you need to relax a little bit, go ahead and do it. I'll try and keep you entertained a little bit. I really need to thank the staff of ASA that's here and the staff in Todd's office, because my wife and I showed up here through a relatively uninteresting story with broken feet. Both right feet have mending bones in them, and these people have just gone way out of their way to make our lives much simpler and get us around campus, and I greatly appreciate that. In addition, I have to thank Bob for the opportunity and an honor to speak with you. And it really is an honor, because as Bob said, we showed up at Princeton about the same time, and Bob's one of the first people I met on campus, and we do not have to mention Bob how long ago that was. That's fine. It was a long time, though. And so we don't see each other every day. We're working on two different campuses, but we see each other frequently enough. In other words, he knows something about me, and yet he still invited me to speak to you. So thank you, Bob. There's a lot of trust in that. On the one hand, thank you, and on the other hand, maybe not so much thanks. I'll tell you why. So if you had asked me to give a talk on my science, on our CO2 chemistry, piece of cake, I do it all the time, no problem. I probably would have started thinking about it about the time I got on the plane to fly down here, to be honest. And on the other hand, if I was asked to give a word of testimony, that wouldn't be a big problem either. I serve as an elder in our local church, and I can handle that without too much difficulty. But you've asked me to take these two things and somehow put them together, and I've been struggling with that since you asked me to do that. So maybe it's a thank you. the struggle is this. It's not that I have two different boxes here and the two don't meet. The struggle's a little different than that. The struggle doesn't do anything. Let's see. We'll do it this way. Okay. The struggle goes sort of back to this old joke that I have on the top of the slide. You know, typically, if you tell me you have the solution, then you're done working on the problem. But remember, I'm a chemist, and if a chemist has a solution, that just means everything's all mixed up, right? So I have my faith speakers and my science speakers, actually Erla Myers. And in thinking about all of this, this is who I am. And there's no way of really teasing out one from the other. There's no way I'm going to take that green solution for you this afternoon and turn it back into yellow and blue solutions. So you get a package deal, and I'm not going to be able to give you a nice, neat story about there's the science part, there's the faith, this is how they come together. It's all together. So as a result, I need to tell you a little bit, I think, up front about who I am, and in particular, who I am on the faith side. But who I am on the faith side actually starts in a chemistry laboratory. I imagine a lot of you, even though you're not chemists, had to take organic chemistry. How many people took organic chemistry? That's what I thought. Okay, now, I enjoy chemistry. That's obviously why I'm a chemist. But I totally dislike organic chemistry. I will admit. yeah, I see there's some consensus here. But organic chemistry did one really wonderful thing for me. See, when we were undergraduates, it was organic lab course, of course, and my lab bench was right next to a young lady's lab bench. And we started talking together. And she was interested, after learning who I was, about talking about her faith. Now, I'm Jewish. I figured she can talk about her faith. She was this Christian person. It seemed pretty safe. Why not learn about somebody else's theology and interest? She kept doing that. That turned into a friendship, and that discussion about faith went on for a couple years. And her goal was to convince me that maybe I should really examine the claims of Jesus My goal was just to kind of learn the strange ideas she had. And we graduated. We were at UCLA at that time. She went off to graduate school up in Northern California. I went to MIT for graduate studies. And we still kept talking. In those days, talking actually was telephones, if you recall back then, which are used for talking. And during that time, because of what was happening, the first time I was away from home, because when I was at UCLA, I lived at home, it was a commuter campus. I came to understand through what she was saying and my Judaism that, in fact, none of this made any sense unless Jesus was the Messiah and was able to accept him as my personal savior at that point. So it all starts back in organic chemistry. So there's a good side to that. The really good side of that also, for me anyway, is that that young lady is now sitting over there as a professor and my wife. So she's a very compelling professor, I will tell you. Okay, so today, we live close to Princeton. We worship in a non-denominational evangelical church, which is probably pretty much like many of the churches that that you attend. We're involved in leading a little Bible study here. We look pretty, quote-unquote, normal in terms of American evangelical Christianity. But I did mention to you that I am Jewish, and we certainly haven't forgot that. So we have this little bit of strangeness about us in that. In addition to all of the normal Christian things, we consider ourselves Messianic Jewish, and we still follow the various traditions and holidays of the Jewish calendar and are involved with a Jewish group. Also, that's a picture of our son being bar mitzvahed a couple years ago. Actually, this is I pulled this out, Pat, and this is a crazy picture, as you know, because our son now is entering his junior year at Princeton. Happy to report a chemistry major. And here, there's this little guy just a few years ago, and now he looks kind of eye to eye at me and tells me what's right and things like that. So that's something about who we are. Okay, so let's see if we can now take that and move that in a chemical direction. We're interested in CO2 for two reasons. One reason was very nicely highlighted by Terry in his talk earlier in this meeting. It represents a possible liquid fuel source. And the fossil fuels that we have available today are not infinite, and so one would want to be thinking about alternatives. And the second reason is an environmental impact reason. We're putting an awful lot of CO2 into the atmosphere, and although it's a little bit controversial about what the implications of that are, it's beginning to look like climate change is something that we should take very seriously, probably sooner rather than later. And that means we should at least mitigate the amount of CO2 we're putting into the atmosphere, if not get rid of it. We just passed 400 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere in May, which to me is a very scary number because the historical number is more like 270. So we're way up there. And as my good friend Nate Lewis put out, you know, about the best thing you can say about that is we have entered into an experiment which no one knows the answer. And we really want to be in that situation. Okay. Biblically, I think we have something to say about that. We're really good at remembering this verse. And by we, I don't mean we, a Christian community. I mean we, even people that don't read the Bible. But we look around us, we see the earth. We have this statement here on leaving the Garden of Eden that it's given to us to work the ground. And we do that, whether or not we know we're following that mandate or not. We're good at taking not only the ground, but all of nature, and making it do what we would like it to do, and taking from it what we would like. And James teaches us not only do we want to do this, but we've been rather successful at this. Now, he's limiting himself in this particular statement to taming animals. We said, you have the right to do this, and look, we've tamed just about every animal you can imagine might be tamed. So we've succeeded in that mandate. You know, by the way, about the time that Bob contacted me and asked me to give this talk, I was leading that Bible study group I showed you a picture of, and we were studying the book of James, and this verse popped up. And this verse doesn't really have a lot to do with the topic of ecology. It's an ecological statement, but it has to do more with how one uses your tongue, turns out. But I detoured for about 10 minutes on, you know, what is the implication of this, not only in terms of how we behave, but in terms of how we respond to our natural environment. And at the end of that Bible study, Pat turned to me and said, "You're already thinking about this talk that you have to give next summer, right?" So that's how far it goes back. Okay, so we succeeded, I guess, in that sense. What we don't do so well is a statement in Genesis that comes a chapter earlier when Adam and Eve are still in the Garden of Eden, where the mandate is not only to work it, but to keep it. That is the stewardship aspect of all of this. And we kind of like to drop that last little phrase out. It's not there in Genesis 3:23, so why not just drop it out of Genesis 2:15? We're kind of headed in that direction. But the mandate really is to be good stewards of our natural resources. And again, James, he's talking about how we interact with other people, but he makes this blanket statement: "You've lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You fatten your hearts in a day of slaughter." We take what we want from the earth. We work it just fine. We know how to process it. But in terms of that stewardship mandate, we don't do a really good job about that. And there's a very ominous statement in Revelation. It's unclear exactly what destroying the earth is, but I would argue that one way you can destroy the earth is to imbalance the ecology, and that there is a penalty for doing that, that you are under judgment if that is your point of view. Okay. Well, I think what I just said has a lot more to behind it than just this issues of energy and CO2. I heard a very interesting talk from Dr. David Kahan from the Weizmann Institute a few years ago. And I borrowed a slide from his. And he listed, it's not a Bible-based talk, but he listed 10 issues that he thought were sort of the top big social issues that we face today that science and engineering has something to say about, starting with energy and going all the way through things like poverty, disease, population growth, terrorism, et cetera, et cetera. And his point was, it doesn't matter which of these you think is the most important. The order here, 1 through 10, doesn't matter. But no matter which one you think it is, it all comes back to this issue of energy. You can't solve any of these problems without having sufficient energy. Okay. And so we need new ways of doing that without further harming the environment. Okay. Now, going back to this issue of harming the environment. This idea of climate change and global warming, CO2 in the atmosphere, has an appearance of being a fairly new issue. Back in the early 90s, if you talked about that, nobody really knew what you were talking about. That was not on people's radar screens, certainly not the public at large. In fact, I'd even say the scientific enterprise, it wasn't high on their radar screens. There were a few places like Princeton that were thinking about it, but this wasn't a big deal. Nonetheless, you can go back in the literature, and this is somebody that I think everybody knows who's ever taken a chemistry course, Arrhenius. Arrhenius published most of his work in Swedish because he was Swedish. But he around the time that he was doing his studies, the Beer-Lambert law that allowed him to correlate absorbance with concentration became known. And he had a rather clever idea, and that was he could calculate the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, he realized, by using the moon as his optical source and taking it in two different positions in the sky, so we have two different path lengths, and seeing what the difference was at the frequencies where CO2 is absorbing. In order to do that, he needed data. He was more of a theoretician than an experimentalist. He needed some data, so he came to the United States. He came to Philadelphia, where the Office of Naval Research and the Naval Research Laboratories were then located, and they had the data he needed. So he was there collaborating with Americans in Philadelphia, and so he writes his paper in English in Philosophical Review, one of the few things he writes in English, and he's talking about something here called, we don't want that. That disciples, the fatal mistake. There we go. Okay. He's talking here about something he calls carbonic acid. Let's see if I can push the right button this time. Carbonic acid, which today we call CO2. He's talking about the CO2 in the atmosphere, and he does the calculation I just described to you, and he points out how much is there. And then at the end of this paper, 1896, he says, you know, we're burning an awful lot of coal these days. As the population increases and as we get more industrialized, we burn more coal, and that's putting more CO2 in the atmosphere. And we can anticipate that the surface temperature of the Earth will increase as time goes on as a result of this. Then he goes on to say, that's good news, because the population is growing, we need more food to feed them, things are a little warmer, then that will be a good effect, we'll have more crops, more productivity, everything will balance out. So he was kind of encouraging with regard to this. So he got most of the story right, but he was just thinking about what happens in Northern Europe when things warm up, not the rest of the world. And he publishes. And so it's been out there. It's been out there for a long, long time. Now, you know, these days, of course, you publish a paper, it comes out in electronic format first, and then people get to write comments underneath it. And you get instantaneous feedback, for better or worse. And Philosophical Journal magazine did the same thing. It was a little slower, but they record comments that people wrote in about this article. And as soon as he published this article, you start to see a series of comments about Arrhenius doesn't know what he's talking about. He thinks that people can actually change God's creation. People don't have that ability to do that. God is you know, God is big. He controls the temperature of the earth and what's in the atmosphere and whatnot. And Arrhenius, you must be out of your mind thinking that us small people can do anything about this. And so that debate about climate change, no climate change, CO2, has been raging for a long, long time. Okay. Perhaps one simple way of looking at this and getting some handle on this is this video that's been put out by a group called Berkeley Climate Study. And you can find this online at berkeleyearth.org. And they've collected in excess of 1.6 million temperature measurements going back all the way to 1750. And that graph at the bottom is how the temperature is changing. It goes from +1 degree to -1 degree. This is the average temperature of the whole Earth. And a degree is a big deal difference. And you can see as time's going on, what you're observing here in the color is the temperature of the Earth. I only started you at 1800 because I didn't figure you wanted to go all the way back to 1701 or so. So I'm going through 200 years right now of temperature history, and it's averaged and it's been validated statistically. And the way they did this is they arbitrarily picked the years from 1950 to 1980, and they took the average of that, and they just called that the zero point. And so the colors, the blue are below that, the yellow we're getting to now is above that, red is even hotter than that. Okay. So the first comment to make is, I just showed you 200 years of history in under a minute. I challenge any history professor to beat that. Second thing is, it's pretty dramatic what's happened here in terms of temperature when you see it visually like this. We are warming up. Okay. Now, we can argue about what's causing that, but it's hard to argue whether or not we're warming up. And as I said, going all the way back to Arrhenius, people have been concerned about CO2 as the source of this global warming. And one of the things that one has to be worried about is we use a lot of coal these days to generate electricity. So here's a coal-fired power plant. Here's your plug for fusion. Coal-fired power plant, that stuff you see coming out of the smokestacks, that's water vapor. You can't see CO2, but I promise you there's an equal amount of CO2 coming out of those stacks. If you have a 1 gigawatt coal-fired power plant, you're generating 1,000 pounds of CO2 per second. I heard that number when I was up at a visit at GE, and I more or less said at that point to the people that were hosting my visit, there's not a thing I can do to help you. That much CO2, can't handle it. Okay, that's a crazy amount of CO2. And they said, well, that's not the end of the story. Here's a map of the coal-fired power plants in the United States, and the size of the circles there tells you how big the plant is. The color, we don't have to worry about, that's how much they cost to build them. But all these circles about this size, those are 1 gigawatt plants. There's a lot of them. Okay, and when I gave you that number of 1,000 per second, then that was 1,000 pascal per second. That was just for one of those plants. And I have a question in the back. Am I allowed to take a question now? Is that okay? You know what I'm going to do? Because Terry is the master of that answer, I think, right? I'm going to defer that one to him later on. How's that? It's a huge amount of energy, right? But yeah, this is what's driving the United States today in terms of coal-fired power plants. So we have more than that, of course. We have gas and we have uranium-based fission plants and things like that. But my point simply is we have a lot of that. And as time goes on, we're going to want more because, in general, our electricity demand goes up. Okay. So we have that. We need that. One comment is, you know, even if you think that's a bad idea, it would be a really bad idea to make that go away tomorrow because we depend on that power source. And no one here would want to live in a country where all that disappeared instantaneously. Okay, so there is a stewardship mandate, I've argued before. And are we meeting that? I'd argue we are not meeting that. Even if you don't think that CO2 is giving rise to global temperature changes, putting that much CO2 into the atmosphere from a pure chemical and physics point of view has got to cause a change, whatever it might be. You are not really being a good steward of your resources and your environment if you do that. Certainly for some reason, if it's not this reason, but I suspect it is this reason. Okay, so I'm going to argue that God wants us to think outside the box about this. So we have a problem. The solution is not just to shut down the power plants. The solution is not employ another technology, because today we really don't have another technology to put in its place instantaneously. You know, a lot of people are working on it, but you're not going to get that beautiful new shiny power plant made doing whatever, solar, fusion, whatever it might be tomorrow. It's a ways down the road, wind. Okay. So let me turn your attention to a story you all know. I'm not intending you for you to read this because it's not an eye chart thing. It's just the parable of the talents. And I think you all know this. And I just want to point out something very simple. This parable, this story, focuses on the third servant who receives the funds and does nothing with them, right? And as a result, when we read this, we focus on this also. I went and hid your talent in the ground, he says to, here you have what is yours, but his master answered him, you wicked and slothful servant. We always look at that. We more or less ignore the first two servants who did the right thing and they get rewarded for doing that. And the first two did exactly the same thing. He who has received the 5 talents is the one I picked in this case, went at once and traded with them, and he made 5 more talents. Number one, there certainly is an argument here that entering into business is something that is okay for a follower of Jesus to do. Right? There's some banking going on here and some trading, stock market maybe, who knows. Right? And number two is, it wasn't the obvious thing to do. Probably this was the obvious thing to do, or actually the parable tells us the obvious thing to do was to put it in the bank at least and get a little bit of interest on it. Okay, and so the first two servants were creative in their thinking, and they had an issue, and they came up with their own solution. So I think this is also a mandate to be a little imaginative, a little creative in how we approach problems, think a little bit outside the box. I think it's sitting right there in the New Testament. So along those lines, let me tell you a story of something that I did at Princeton. We have a requirement in my department for our juniors to do what's called a junior paper, where a group of juniors will meet with a professor for a period of about a month and discuss something and then write up a paper about it. And so a couple of years ago, I had 3 students who were meeting with me simultaneously. Their names have been changed to protect the innocent. And I put before them the question of, okay, we have all the CO2. We want to do something with it chemically. What should we do with it? I want you to go out to the literature and find something you find attractive as a way of processing the CO2. And I call this the Tupperware problem. You can see. And the reason is the first student came back in, and she said, I found this marvelous chemistry that's being done up at Cornell by Professor Jeffrey Coates. And he's taking CO2, and he's taking some of their natural products, and he's putting them together to make new polymers that can be used as plastics. And we could take those plastics, and they're very similar to the materials that are used to make Tupperware. We can make Tupperware out of it. That's a great answer. And then I went to the next student, and he found that you could reduce CO2 down to elemental carbon. And he said, elemental carbon, that's used as a blacking agent. In particular, the black of your tires is the fact that they put carbon into your tires. And so here we have a resource for making all these new tires. We'll make tires with our CO2. And then there was a third student, who's the brilliant student in the group, now off in medical school, and he said, oh, Professor Bocarsley, clearly what we should do with the CO2 is we should do your chemistry. We should take CO2 and use your process to convert it into methanol, and we'll use that as a fuel. So I said, okay, now we have to decide, of your three suggestions, which one we should do. And I told them about, I showed them that picture and told them that little fact I just told you about 1,000 pounds of CO2 per second coming out of a power plant. And student number A, responded, no one can use that much Tupperware. And that's exactly right. There is not a solution to this problem. There are a whole bunch of solutions. If we want to get CO2 out of our smokestacks, out of our atmosphere, we're going to have to implement a whole bunch of different solutions. There's not one magic chemistry, one magic solution that will take care of the problem, because there's just too much to do anything with. Now, having said that, one way you might think about what you're going to do is ask yourself, how do we use fossil fuels today? Okay. It turns out, of our fossil fuels that we dig out of the ground, 93% today are used for making fuels. Okay? And only 7% goes into what I would call soft materials, polymers, materials like that. Now, when you make soft materials, of course, you totally bind up the CO2 and it's not out there anymore. When you make fuels, you're going to burn it again and make more CO2. So you're sort of recycling the CO2. Okay, so that's the downside of that. But nonetheless, there's no reason to believe that this ratio, 93-7, is going to change if we were to switch over to a new feedstock. And therefore, if you want to get rid of a lot of CO2, or at least bind it up for a short time, you've got to make fuels. You really don't have another option for doing that. So I'm an electrochemist. I want to make fuels. How am I going to do that? I'm going to do that electrochemically. Okay, very simple. I'm going to take CO2, react it with water, put some energy in. I'm going to make methanol and generate some oxygen in doing that. Oxygen is going to be like that. And we're going to do this in an electrochemical cell. So let me just remind you, if you haven't done any electrochemistry for a little while, you have two compartments. You have a cathode compartment where reduction takes place. And in that compartment, we're going to take the CO2. Whoops, come back. We're going to take the CO2, and we're going to combine it with some protons and some electrons. That's going to make the methanol. And on the other side, at the anode, oxidation, we're going to oxidize water to generate oxygen. And that slide right there tells you you've got a big problem, because sticking 6 electrons into a CO2 molecule is not going to be easy. So you've got some issues that you're going to have to deal with. Okay. So before we go ahead, even if I tell you I can do this, we need to think about, what is it going to cost us to do this? So we're going to count the cost of doing all this before we go and build our tower, right? So we start off here with CO2 and water, and then just based on the thermodynamics of the problem, to turn that into methanol and oxygen is going to require 690 kilojoules per mole. This probably doesn't help you, because we were just talking about gigawatts, and now I'm on kilojoules per mole. This is a much smaller amount of energy. That requires 1.2 volts to move those 6 electrons. That's not too bad. Okay, but if we get that current to do that from a power plant, and now I'm not going to use a coal-fired power plant. I'm going to go cleaner. I'm going to use a gas-fired power plant. I use some numbers from the Department of Energy about how much CO2 is generated by such a power plant. For every molecule of CO2 we get rid of this way, we're going to generate 2.25 more molecules of CO2, according to that calculation. That doesn't sound like good news, but that's not the end of the bad news. Okay? We go from worse. Now, it turns out that's like the minimum amount of energy you need. That's the minimum energy to get through the door. That's not the amount of energy you need if you want to do this at any kind of rate that will make any sense. Okay, we need to overcome an activation barrier if we want to do this at a rate that makes some sense. And so we're going to have to add some more energy on top of that. And if you look at numbers that are available in the literature, you are not going to be able to do it for less than about another 400 millivolts on the oxygen side and another volt on the CO2 side. And I'm being really optimistic when I give you those numbers. People tell me I'm crazy. So it's at least 1.4 volts, another 170 kilojoules per mole. If you're a true optimist, it probably will never happen. That generates some more CO2, another half a molecule of CO2 or so doing that. And here's my arithmetic over here. I get rid of one mole of CO2. I generate 2.82 in doing it. So my way of getting rid of CO2 is to generate almost two moles of CO2 instead of getting rid of anything. Okay? So that doesn't sound so good. Well, the answer to this is very simple. Don't use a gas-fired power plant to do this. Find another energy source that might do this. So maybe you want to do this with sunlight, light energy. Other ways you might do it, but Bob already pointed out that I do solar photochemistry, so we'll use sunlight. If we're going to do that, it doesn't change the numbers on the left-hand side there. They're all the same. That's the way the game is played. Okay. So instead of running this with kind of moles and kilojoules and whatnot, if I want to do this, it's going to take a 3 eV photon for those of you who are physicists, or for those of you who aren't, light that's at the verge between the visible and the ultraviolet part of the spectrum. The kind of light we just don't have here at the surface of the Earth. So that's not going to work so well either. There is some good news in all this, and that is the whole problem is in that yellow box. Okay, if I can make that yellow box smaller, then I can use photons that are a reasonable size that I have. And I don't have to make the yellow box disappear. Okay, if I wanted to, say, cut that yellow box off right at this level right here, that'd be very optimistic. But now I could use 1.6 eV photons. Those are red photons. Got plenty of those. So that would work. But even if I go up here in sort of the middle of where that yellow box was before, that's 1.8 to 2 eV photons. Those are yellow-green photons. Those are the photons that our sun puts out more than any other wavelengths of light. Okay, so if I can just take that box and cut it in half, I can do this with sunlight. Well, to cut that box in half, I need a catalyst that will lower the energy to drive this reaction. And we discovered that catalyst quite by accident. It's this molecule right here, pyridinium. It's a very common garden variety molecule that nobody would have looked at, including us, but we found it by accident. And what happens is you can reduce this molecule on an electrode, and once it's reduced, it reacts with CO2, and it will do the conversion we're interested in. It takes three steps to do it. Each time we go, we take one of these molecules, these pyridiniums, we reduce it by an electron to make what's called a pyridinyl. That then reacts with CO2. If you do that circle twice, you have formic acid. Then you find another one of them, and you do it twice again, formic acid to formaldehyde, and then formaldehyde to methanol. And it works remarkably efficiently. Okay? And it also means, by the way, I not only can make methanol, I can make any of these molecules. I can make formic acid, I can make formaldehyde by doing this. And we actually do it. It looks something like this. Here's a little photoelectrochemical cell. And what you're seeing over here is a little semiconductor gallium phosphide chip. We're irradiating it with this blue light here. Many of you, unfortunately, probably know this blue light. If you've ever had a filling in recent years at the dentist's office, it's a photocured epoxy, and he puts a little light thing in your mouth. That's what we're using here. That's the same light source. We use that because it's FDA regulated. So every time we buy one, we get exactly the same thing. So we call this dental blue. So if we illuminate our gallium phosphide with dental blue, then we start seeing methanol formed here. And there's that little dark thing right there as a counter electrode where the oxygen is coming off. And 96% of the electrons we generate this way go into make methanol, virtually everything. This is a very efficient way of making methanol. And it works. It works so well that a group of investors contacted me and said, maybe we should think about starting a company that does this sort of thing. That sounded intriguing, and that was the birth of Liquid Light. This was in 2008. We started talking. By 2009, we decided it was worth going ahead with something. And so we have our little electrochemical cell right here. You just saw a real one. This one is made with metal electrodes at liquid light instead of the semiconductor. And we're going to hook that up to some sort of energy source instead of supplying the light right into the cell. That could be solar cells, for example, that we use. That could be wind. That could be the fusion reactor that we're all promised. Anything as long as it doesn't use fossil fuel is good. It's going to drive this reaction over here where we're going to oxidize water to oxygen, reduce CO2 to methanol or other products over there. We'll get our CO2 from some point source that generates a lot of CO2, 15% of the gas coming out of a coal-fired power plant, CO2. It's a huge amount. And we'll make liquid fuels. And so that's the whole game plan for liquid light. It's the idea. Now, there's only one little problem with this game plan. And it comes out of this diagram I discovered that our first speaker Thursday evening, told us. He showed us this 2x2 array, and he pointed out that if you're starting a company and you want to have some idea that's going to have a successful outcome, then you want to have both good ends and you want to have an effective means. So you want to be in that upper right box. That sounded about right. And he pointed out the other boxes are problematic. And when I look at myself, I think the idea of liquid light, where we're going to take CO2, I see the stewardship asset, and turn it into something that we can all use, is a good idea, and it has good ends associated with it. But I also know myself and my ability to be a businessman. I think I'm great in the lab. I can go in the lab. I can do problem solving, no problem. I can get a result pretty quickly, I still think. I think in the business world and running a company and dealing with raising huge amounts of money and government issues and all kinds of other things, I think I'm in the ineffective means category. And so the way we solve this problem is, as you already know, I'm the science advisor to the company. I stay totally out of the day-to-day working of the company. We only interact on issues of chemistry and engineering and physics and things like that. And I let people that are much more competent in running a company run the company. And what that has led to is a first-generation device that looks like this. Okay. The cell that we're dealing with now is this guy right here. This is all control stuff and monitoring stuff so we can figure out what in the world it's doing. But here's the cell. It works on metal electrodes. It's got 100 square centimeters of active surface area. That little cell I showed you on the couple slides back, it's got a couple square millimeters of surface area. Okay, this is half the size you need right here to run a real live pilot plant type cell. So we more or less have solved that. This is not a static cell, it's a flow cell. There's a pump over here. And this cell makes formic acid, the first compound, which is what we were targeting in that little scheme I showed you a couple minutes ago. And it makes it with the type of efficiency in terms of use of electricity and the rate that is commercially viable. Now, what one has to do is actually take a whole bunch of these and stack them up to make an electrolyzer for CO2. And here's just three of them stacked up together. They're plumbed together. They're electrically connected. And just to show that, in fact, we could do this in an environmentally sensitive way. If you've been in New Jersey lately, then you know just about every telephone pole in New Jersey has a silicon photoarray on it these days that PSE&G has put up there from this company, Petra Solar. And PSE&G was very generous and lent us a couple of them. So here's one of them. They're about 5 feet tall and 3 feet wide. And we're using that single cell to run our little stack over there. And this stack is generating formic acid, and it's doing it with a little under 2% total conversion efficiency, energy conversion efficiency, 1.86% if you want to get technical. That is to be compared with an announcement out of Panasonic about 9 months ago now on a little cell, like the one I showed you before, where they said, we have a world's record for solar conversion to formic acid in a photoelectric chemical cell of 0.2%, 0.2%. So we're almost an order of magnitude higher here, and we're using components that you can get today. The only thing you can't get to get today really is the magic electrodes that we put in there, but we can get them. Okay. So this is quite doable. You can do this, and you can do this with an efficiency that makes sense. And you can use sunlight to do this or other alternate energy sources. Well, one last thing. The one thing I haven't shown you anything of in this talk, and it's making me feel somewhat remiss, is data. I just want to show you one example of the kind of data we collect here. So this is a current voltage curve, and this is on a semiconductor and a photoelectric chemical cell again, and this is a pretty special photoelectric chemical cell, I need to tell you. It uses a gallium arsenide photoelectrode, P-type electrode, and what we're doing is we're looking at it in the dark, and we're looking at it under illumination, and we're scanning the potential and looking at the current. And in the dark, the black line here, you notice not much is happening, which is good. This is a photoelectrode. And then we turn on the light and we see a current, a cathodic current for reduction. And in this red curve, we have no CO2 around. We just have the catalyst around. And you can see, we see this current. That's the reduction of the catalyst by light. Okay? And then we put the CO2 in and we get the blue curve, even more current. That's the reduction of the CO2. So that's the sort of information we get out of this. And we take whatever's in that soup that we end up with afterwards and we do an analysis on that. And in this particular case with gallium arsenide, we find out that what we are making in this is formic acid. It's selectively going to formic acid. And we take that same electrode now, and we put a little bit of platinum on it. We plate a little platinum on it, and we do a really lousy job of doing it. So there's just islands of platinum, and the gallium arsenide is showing through these islands. And we run the experiment again when we do that, and we do our data analysis again. We're doing it by NMR. And instead of making formic acid, we make isopropanol, rubbing alcohol. This is really exciting because now I'm hooking carbons together, making carbon-carbon bonds. Everything else I showed you didn't have any carbon-carbon bonds. Carbon-hydrogen, yes, but no carbon-carbon. Okay. If you want to make a real fuel, you need to make carbon-carbon bonds. So rubbing alcohol isn't quite a fuel, but it's got two carbon-carbon bonds in it. And it turns out this same cell, if you run it under the correct conditions, will not only make isopropanol, and that is right here, 60% goes to isopropanol, but we'll also make butanol. And when I go across campus, butanol, where's the butanol go? There's the butanol. When I go across campus and talk to our combustion engineers and say, what's the smallest molecule I can get away with and call it a fuel, they say, give us butanol. Okay. And here we have 20% of our electrons approximately going to make a real-life fuel. I don't have to tell you a story about how I can take that methanol and maybe turn it into a fuel or something like that. There it is. I can make solar fuels, liquid materials. So with that, I need to thank the people that have done all this work and thank you for your attention. So let me point out on the left there is my research group. I've been working on this. And on the right-hand side is a picture that was taken right at the beginning of liquid light, and I think that's 2009. And we really bulked up that picture. That is this smiling young man back there. Kyle Teamy is the president of the company. He's a big driving force in this. He's the guy who knows what he's doing in terms of those two-by-two array business things. And then two other important people. The young lady here, you'll notice, also is on the left-hand diagram. She graduated from my research group. She did just about all the chemistry I told you about today, except for that last little bit I told you about. And she's now the principal scientist at Liquid Light, and the other gentleman who's also a key research scientist. So it was really the three of them, and the rest of us, the people on the ends, were sort of the business money people. They were giving money to the company, and there's some advisors. You can see I'm in that picture. It was made to look like there really was a company there and not just three people, but to be honest, it was three people in 2009, and today that company is 25 people running on about a $10 million budget. So things seem to be working out well. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention. Just leave you with this. Oh, changed here, but didn't change there. Okay. This last thought. God gives us choices. He gives us free will. And he asks us to make the right choices. So thank you very much for your attention.